at some point we'll start catching our dream. So it'll be a dreamy place where probably maybe nighttime dream. What our narrative was. So, if possible, we catch our dream. Maybe you don't actually remember the nighttime dream tonight, but before you came here, you drove. Right? Maybe walked, I don't know. It's a dream. So we catch, so to speak, how we got here. So we don't lose that continuity. Oh, I kind of dreamed I got in my car, I got dressed, and here I am. So the shock, so to speak, or not knowing or being here is broadening so that the dream world can come in. So let's spend a few moments recalling our dream. You put on your clothes and you got here. Seems so real, this dream. Where your present moods and thoughts begin to arrive. Reveries before the to-dos. I've got to let the dog out. I've got to do this before task. So things are like are kind of floating in like a river. So the river and the ocean meet and you have the real reverie, kind of, what do they call it, estuary? Kind of nice birds and creatures where the river meets the ocean. It's an interesting place. Big ocean, salty water, river, fresh water, and you have interesting birds and plants there. So the reverie of the river meets the ocean of the dreams. And we appreciate that kind of mix. You let the reverie, you let things kind of just flow in and mix. Flow in from the day and mix with the dream. It's easy. So let's take a few minutes for that. Now, as a result of resting in kind of open zero state and dream and reverie, the garden aspect kind of comes together. You know, things start growing and flowers, and we're by the water, and water's there, and flowers, and then the refuge tree comes up, you know. Our Bodhi tree comes up, and all the Bodhisattvas, Buddhas, Dharma protectors, Kidams, so forth, with our Lama in the center arises, you know. So we're out in this beautiful garden, and the refuge tree, lineage tree, shows up, right? You know. So the arises out of this space, and that's when we see, visualize, imagine, like all the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, protectors, Yidams, Dakini, so forth. Then they're sending light and smiling at us, right? Let's start that. Start that way. The Dakinis, you know, and goddesses ringing bells and singing. So we let that light pour into us. You know, kind of new agey, right? You know, we're waking up and the rainbows and unicorns and dancing goddesses, Dakinis, everything, and they're sending us basically love and light, yeah? So streaming into a basically Om, Ah, Hung, least white, red, and dark blue body, speech, mind. So we're in this big garden in front of this tree, and luminous kind of trees and flowers and rainbows, etc., and streaming into us. And we let our mind rest on that for a moment. Now the Mandala Temple Palace arises, so we go in Eastern Gate and take our seat. We're surrounded by gardens and lakes and ocean and so forth. And then ready to do prayers to establish motivation and nine breaths to cleanse channels. But now it's like 8:40, so we need to have like, since this is workshop, we need to have like time for questions like that. Briefly, you know, I'm saying when we meet here for regular services, of course, the assumption is like, in some sense, we've already done all this in the morning, so we just like jump into doing the prayers, right? Or since it's kind of public, you know, we're not doing the amount of inner work, so to speak, so we just jump into the prayers. But since these workshops are like maybe for some people mini retreat, or at least preparing people to do retreat, then we have to start slowly like this. Actually, if you do it this way every day, it's better. So this is maybe like 40 minutes. And you go, well, when do I start? Well, this is 40 minutes of this. And then we do prayers and do whatever, kind of like shamatha or something, right, which we'll do. So, of course, the only way to do the kind of full practices that we're learning in the workshops is to get up earlier or go to bed later. Isn't that true? So we have time for some, you know, it's got to be like some questions or discussions, and then we'll take a short break and then start again at 9 with the prayers. This is all easy, right? Easy? Should be easy. Yes? So remembering our nighttime dream, otherwise known as our nighttime mental state, you know, so we're picking up the continuity of that. So it's all about continuity. That's what Tantra is, like the continuity of awareness. So just tying, we're keeping things tied together. So we're kind of, instead of just popping up from the alarm going, oh shit, I gotta, you know, get to work, where there's a big break. Actually, the beginning of our traumatization of ourselves in the morning is the alarm going off and us going like, oh my God, you know, like that. So that's the beginning of most people's day, which is called trauma. So instead, we just like, you know, we're waking up and we're keeping the continuity of the mind. So that's why we're remembering the dream. Yeah, hi.
Hi. So I had a dream the night before last, in particular. It was a nightmare. So it was so scary that I didn't want to go back to sleep. And I was running from people in and out of the building. And jumping down the stairs and in the bed. And then my thought process as I woke and throughout the day was continuous, you know, like with that fear. And so how do you, like, what's the best way to get out of that?
even before you know, we're remembering the dream, whether we call it nightmare or what, you know, there's a moment of just pure awareness. Nothing's happening, really. Just, you know, we could call it pure awareness or before thinking or don't know mind, you know, where is that. Usually people don't catch that because we're so speedy, freaked out, but there's that, you know, so that becomes the ground. Actually, ground Mahamudra, right? So there's nothing happening. And then we remember the dream. So by gaining confidence in the ground Mahamudra, then we know that whether the dream's good or bad, it actually is just dream. We recognize this dream. If we don't recognize it as dream, then of course we do what ordinary sentient beings do, is reify it and objectify it and fixate and become solid and real, and then we scare the shit out of ourselves. Yeah. So the recognition of pure awareness, just open nature, stays with us enough, and then the dream feels still dreamy instead of going into solid. And then of course we bring in the reverie, you know, we start bringing in the soft qualities, the nice river, and then of course the garden and the refuge tree arrive. So then we gain the blessings and the impairments. If we don't do that, if we just kind of like bad dream, then oh no, you know, and then we'll continue to process the bad dream because we haven't remembered pure awareness, we haven't allowed the soft reverie to come in, and then we haven't done, you know, taking the blessings of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and the garden and the refuge tree, and then, you know, then we're just all vermished like that. So recognizing dream means we're recognizing this is a dream, whether it's good or bad, like that. Actually, sometimes, you know, bad dreams are, we're just being pursued by people that want to get a hold of us, and once they get a hold of us, they're very, very nice. You know, It's like, if you don't answer, sometimes even at the Midway Health Office, like FedEx or UPS drivers will really like knock on the door really loudly. You know, they might start off like, but then, you know, if I don't get up and answer, it'll be, you know, and then they'll really like whack the hell out of the door. So maybe people have been meeting with me. I just say, excuse me, I'll open it up. Otherwise, they get really loud. So sometimes bad dreams are just delivery messengers that they're just trying to get our attention, but we haven't answered the first time, you know. We have to answer when the knock is very soft. That's why we develop that softness and kind of slow wake up. But we'll talk more about dreams. But you need to have that sequence, kind of zero state, just pure awareness, then dreams, then reverie, then garden and refuge tree, and then you're in your temple mandala, palace, mansion, you know, and then you do the prayers. Yeah. Y'all gonna remember this? Yeah. You will? You'll remember it?
I have a question.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah, good. It's a dream.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. That's, Western psychology, even very depth psychology, like Jungian and post-Jungian analytic, very interested in really the content, the power of the content of the dreams, right? And we are in Dharma too, but that's still relative truth. So the most important thing is we want to recognize the dream as the dream, the dreamlike nature of the mind. So, you know, most people say, I got really scared because I was chased by blah, blah, or this bad thing happened or something, or I woke up feeling bad, which is the content, the result of the content and believing the dream. And then, but we have, the primary thing is we have to recognize it as dream. So like looking in the mirror in the morning, first thing you just have to recognize, oh, I'm looking at a reflection of myself. Yeah, like that. Otherwise, we get a little psychotic and we think, you know, there's someone else looking at the other side of the mirror, right? Maybe the older we get, we go, that's not me, is it? You know, so, but... That's the, you know, actually the first thing is we recognize that, you know, go, oh, that's my reflection, right? But it's just reflection. Yeah.
I was going to say, well, the one thing about dreams that I found interesting was sharing with my colleagues, the commonality of some of the dreams we were having as nurses. I have this recurring dream that as I'm filling out the assignment, I forget to assign patients. So we went the whole shift, and the patient wasn't taken care of by a nurse.
Yeah.
And we're, other nurses are having that dream. I found that very interesting, mm-hmm. where I wake up, and I'm like so stressed and overwhelmed that you know, I messed up the assignment, and other people are having the same dream.
Yeah, when you work together or you live together or do retreat together, we actually even have sometimes exact same dream. Of course, we're having the same dream. We're here at Dona Dargay, right? So we could say we're having the same dream. But yeah, we can have, you can actually have the same nighttime dream, which once again we can get involved in content. Of course, that's important. But basic realization is, you know, this interdependent, you know, co-arising, co-dissolving. You know, that's it. If we recognize, oh, this is how Pratityasamutpada works, this is how interdependence works, and then there's a realization. Because usually we kind of go, well, that's weird, but we don't take it to the next step like, oh, this is how it is. It really all rises together and all dissolves together. It's weird, isn't it? Okay, so we should, you know, take a few minute break. Did you have a question? Oh, who am I missing? Oh, hi. Tell me your name again.
Jennifer.
Jennifer, right, hi. Thanks, Jennifer, yeah. Yeah, hi, Jennifer, yeah. There are a lot of different kind of dream yoga practices, right? Where, of course, you can, you know, kind of lucid dreaming kinds of things we call in the West. So you can do that. And sometimes that's helpful. And that's working on the level of relative reality, of course. Absolute reality is, you know, nothing's happening. You know, like when we're watching a movie or TV, nothing's really happening, right? Just images, right? So we have to always recognize that. But even though phenomenal world is dreamlike, we still want to have a good dream, right? Right. Let's have a good dream. So this practice is to do that, yeah. But you have to be sometimes careful because to have a practice is to have some teachings, because sometimes people go in and they say, I just want to change this so that, you know, so that's nicer, or that person isn't there. But they don't realize that just like it's a Jenga, you know, if you take out one, the whole thing starts shifting again. So that's why people, so you end up being the sorcerer's apprentice sometimes, you know, if you don't really do enough dream yoga, you kind of like, you switch things up a little bit, you know, you get rid of something you don't like and put in something you like, but then you don't recognize the whole environment of the dream shifts too. Which can sometimes good, but sometimes if you're not having a holistic vision, then you know, it's kind of like, you know, spraying DDT on the bugs, you know, then eventually, you know, it becomes a problem. So, yeah, this is a good question. So, we'll talk about dreams later. Okay, so, stretch, go to the bathroom. That's good, right? La, la, la. We'll do some 9 breaths and prayers. The prayers are designed around the generally around the three principal aspects of the path. Which is a famous teaching by Lama Tsongkhapa. And the three principal aspects are renunciation, bodhicitta, and the wisdom realizing emptiness. So in the prayers, that's kind of a progression where we're developing renunciation of our destructive deeds and stupid ideas, which entails, of course, also developing devotion and confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and the Lama. And that's why we start out praise to Shakyamuni. And then we develop the aspirations of relative and ultimate bodhicitta, the strong spirit to awaken for ourselves and others. And then we usually conclude with Heart Sutra, right? Which is teaching on ultimate nature, emptiness, wisdom realizing emptiness, right? Prajna Paramita. So it has that progression, right? So a lot of times people are doing the prayers, but they go, well, I don't know what I'm supposed to be thinking, feeling, or doing. Well, first of all, pay attention to what you're saying. That's a big one. And, you know, but the basic structure of that we're developing the desire to leave our destructive patterns, our suffering, and start our journey. So to do that, you know, of course we have to feel that things are really painful, and there's a possibility of going somewhere where there's not painful, right? Because people just stay stuck in samsara, in their depression, if they feel there's no way out, right? Because they'll go, well, better the devil I know. I've got my coping skills, and, you know, I'll just stay here and be miserable. So we need to offer, you know, a way out. So when we say renunciation, using that term, kind of sounds almost biblical or something, developing that resolve entails, you know, both some place we want to escape from, but also some faith and hope and confidence that we won't just escape to end up back in the fire, you know, out of frying pan into fire. So a lot of people don't change because even though they admit that their world sucks and they feel horrible, they don't see any alternative. So that's why we start out praise the Shakyamuni, refuge, taking confidence in you know, the Lama, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, like that. So that's the basic structure, you know, renunciation, bodhicitta, and wisdom realizing emptiness, Heart Sutra, Prajna Paramita. That's easy, right? So the prayers are not, I want to be a good little Buddhist, you know, and I don't want to get punished, I want to be a good little Buddhist, you know. We're not back in Sunday school. The practices are, you know, the prayers are really to point out these three essential aspects of the path. That's easy, right? Okay, so let's do them. end of April, we did a Dzogchen Mahamudra retreat at Lotus View Ranch, and a few people have asked me to continue to give teachings on Dzogchen and Mahamudra. So here we are. In our weekly emails, I've asked Erica to put out one verse each time and ask people that are practicing Mahamudra to read one verse a day. Particularly, I'm going to spend some time going over, first verse of the Ganges Mahamudra. This morning, I feel like using Ken MacLeod's translation. And it starts out with, "I bow to Vajra Dakini as homage." And then first verse is, "Mahamudra cannot be taught, Naropa, but your devotion to your teacher and the hardships you've met have made you patient in suffering and also wise. Take this to heart, my worthy student." We can't really teach Mahamudra in the same way that you can't teach someone to have a sense of humor. Or maybe you can't, if someone, if you tell a joke or you hear a comedian tell a joke and the other person kind of says, "I don't get it," it's hard to explain the joke so that they laugh, right? They might kind of go, "Oh, okay. Yeah, I could see how that could be funny." But there's something that has to be immediate and has to be some kind of recognition if something's really funny, right? Or we laugh along with comedian or laugh along at our own jokes, whatever. So in that sense, laughter can't be taught. So Mahamudra, in a sense, as the realization of Mahamudra can't be taught, but nevertheless, we're going to explain the joke. This is why it's funny, so like that. I guess there's, if someone wants to be a professional comedian, there are courses and being a comedian, right? Anybody here ever done stand-up? I don't know, Anybody like going to hear stand-up comedy? Yeah. These days, most comedy is pretty, raw, but it's funny how comedians, and I don't know why, they start on a roll and then you actually just start laughing and it feels good, doesn't it? So even though it can't be taught in that way, Trilopa points to your devotion and your hardships have made you, that's one of the ways you've become receptive, so I can give you these teachings. So those are essential. Devotion means, a heartfelt openness, not a sycophantic, rock star kind of thing, because worshiping in that way, where the teacher is like this brilliant person, and you're an insect, you won't have any transmission that way. So, devotion means you're opening your heart, you're becoming receptive, you're having confidence in your ability to do the practice. So, devotion always entails, heartfelt openness combined with confidence in your Buddha nature, some sense that you can do it. Then hardships. Uh, we can have a sense of the view, we're calling it, some understanding of Dharma, and some glimpse, just as we can sit in the lodge, look through the telescope at the top of the mountain, right? We can see the summit. Has anybody ever done that? You know, I think you can do that in a few, probably in Switzerland, you know, you can sit in the lodge and look at the top of the Jungfrau or something like that, or maybe here in America, so you can see. And there is something inspiring about you can see the whole mountain and you see the summit. So definitely, those are kind of like, lots of times teacher will point out the view, saying, so akin to saying, you know, look in the telescope, or maybe in the nighttime sky you have a telescope and you look and say, oh wow, that's Mars, you know, like that. So you actually have a glimpse. So there can be some, like I call a little pinprick of realization there. But seeing the mountain from the lodge is a lot different than climbing it and standing on the summit. Do you agree? You're going to have a whole different level of appreciation after a climb than just, you know, seeing it through a telescope or just looking at it, you know, let alone just seeing it in a picture, right? For people that are just readers and they imagine, oh, that, I could do that. I could be Milarepa or I could be Naropa. Like, we're just reading about it, right? You know, not even seeing it. But to actually have the making real realizations, we do need to climb the mountain, and that does entail, like, you know, work. I don't know if we have it in the Bodhisattva Vinaya, that I've put together, but I like to say the climb gets harder but the view gets better, right? So you have to turn around every once in a while and look at the view, because of course once about a quarter way up the mountain you can't see the summit anymore, right? And for a long period, you can't see the summit. Or perhaps, like there's a false summit. Anybody climb Mount Shasta? This kind of false summit, right? What's the other little mountain there in Shasta? But Shastina, right? Yeah. So, you know, you can think, well, I'm done now, you know. So there's false summit, and then there's also losing sight of the summit. When people get discouraged, because they're schlepping upwards, I have to always encourage them, and I love encouraging people. When people have gone to, you know, kind of a false summit, those are harder students to work with. It's harder to work with ourselves, because then we feel like, no, we should be the Lama and giving teachings, right? So that's harder to work with, false summits, you know. But nevertheless, so because of our open-heartedness, confidence, and then we have actually made the track, we've walked it, so to speak, then we're becoming what's called fit vessel. Also with mountain, you know, metaphors that they're kind of Dharma shortcuts. They're not really shortcuts. You can't take a helicopter to the top. People want that. Say, I do want to get to the summit. I want to stand on the summit, but Lamala, you know, I want to take the helicopter, something like that, or the tram. You know, have you ever taken a tram up a mountain? You know. That's pretty, you know, but it's different than walking it. We have to walk it. We have to walk the path. So, then third sentence, this has made you patient in suffering and also wise. patience, shanti, is this peaceful endurance, not grit your teeth endurance, but the peaceful endurance of patience is developed, you know, through hardships, through responsibilities, through our shamatha practice, and it's essential, because without patience, then you're angry and impatient, right? Impatient generally means being angry, isn't that so? You know, like stuck in traffic and you're trying to rush, maybe here, and you're impatient, you know. Why don't the a-holes get out of the way? Don't they know I'm trying to get to my meditation? Crazy, yeah. So, hopefully based on some life experience of this, you know, based on our devotion, on the hardships, based on developing patience, which goes for all the paramitas, right? You know, and they're kind of little, you know, if you say one paramita, you know, like, you know, giving and patience and discipline and so forth, meditation effort, in our tradition means you've said them all, right? You know, so, you know, somebody says you're patient, they're also, you know, or say you're a very giving person, you know, the assumption is you're also developing patience and discipline and energy and meditation, and then wisdom comes. So many of us in this room are wiser, hopefully, than, you know, we were as teenagers or something, right? So then Tulopa can say, take this to heart. So take it in the heart. Right, take it in the heart mind. This is the, in our tradition, the clear light mind is here, you know, and it exists in the nintig, the heart drop, right? So not the brain mind. That makes sense, right? Or does it, you know? There is the brain mind. And we recognize the brain mind. We're very interested in the brain mind. They're now people called neuro-Buddhists, right? Interested in the brain. But in our tradition, clear light mind, Rigpa, whatever name you want to give, then that exists as the heart mind. And in our tradition is a continual fresh reemergence every moment. It doesn't have a birth, it doesn't have a death. So, of course, in our tradition, you can be brain dead, but not dead in that sense, because our heart mind is still present. So, in our tradition, if someone's just died, we're still keeping a sense of peace around them, maybe doing prayers or mantras so that they can identify with it. You know, we're not saying critical things about the person, right? Even if people aren't Buddhists, they tend to be kind of nice. Like, after college, I worked at Seventh-day Adventist Hospital, and I was in housekeeping. Of course, after like this huge Ivy League college, I went to be a janitor. Drove my parents nuts, but they were nice. They said, you know, we don't, as housekeepers, we don't rush in after someone's died and just like taking down the flowers. Okay, they're dead. You know, move them. You know, yeah, maybe some hospitals do that. You know, I'm not sure, but. You know, there's still some respect, right? Sometimes people's awareness, you know, leaves immediately, right? After they die. You can feel it, you know, just, oh, they left, great. But usually when the technically medical death, there's not the recognition or personal clear light mind doesn't recognize it, right? We're still kind of like wait a minute, why are they pulling the tubes out? You know, like that, right? So just after someone dies, you don't want to go, well, that's the end of, you know, Aunt Beth, you know, or something. You know, you just want to always still do some prayers, practice, create a inspiring environment, but at the same time, say that, you know, let the person know that they've moved on. Yeah. So have a good journey. So taking it to the heart mind, not the brain mind, right? Not the information mind. Then my worthy student. So finally we end up with worth, and then that was, you know, maybe the Buddha's final doubt. I've talked about this before, like conquered kind of anger and desire, but still like wondered, maybe, you know, I don't deserve this, you know. Fortunately, that's when, you know, he kind of touched the ground. That's so in the refuge Buddha, you see one left hand holding Patra, the alms bowl, and then the other hand is over, right hand over the knee, touching the ground. That's called Bhumi Sparsha Mudra. Bhumi means ground, Sparsha means touching, Mudra means gesture. And then he said, the earth, in some traditions, he said, the earth is my witness, or then also the earth goddess said he's worked for this. So tomorrow, back off. And Mara, the deceiver, slipped away. Isn't that nice? So at least when hearing these teachings, maybe we haven't done as much work on ourselves as Naropa, but we have to be open to the possibility that we're worthy to receive them. Because that unworthiness can be a very hard thing, you know. You can get all these teachings, and then deep down you go, well, they all say I have Buddha nature, they all say I'm worthy, or they all, you know, everyone else seems to be happy, but I've got terminal uniqueness, as we'd say in recovery. Terminal uniqueness is, my problems are more profound than anybody else's. No one can understand me, and I can't be helped. So to go over it again, that's terminal uniqueness. My problems are more profound than anybody else's. No one can understand them, and I can't be helped. It's kind of a badge of honor, right? So I'm not worthy. Thank you very much. You know, I pass. You know. So that hardness can be very stubborn, you know, so much so that, like, there's a phrase in Tibetan that says, even if a rock has been at the bottom of the ocean for a million eons, surrounded by the water at the bottom, if you bring it up and crack it open, it's still dry inside. Okay? So we have to go to, ultimately, to that kind of misperceived self that is the flip side of pride and arrogance. The other side, of course, is I'm fantastic and you guys should worship me, but the one side is I'm bad, stupid, and wrong, broken, and I can't be helped, right? So, you know, the last phrase is my worthy student, so Tulapa's going right to that. So this part of this hour of the treat, mostly talk, and then next time we'll do mostly sitting. So of course this is information, intellect in a sense, right? And in our tradition, we pay attention to intellect and discriminating mind. Why? Because even though intellect and information and belief can't bring you realization, it can prevent you. So if you think you can't, and you won't. So our intellectual narrative can be very good. It can steer us in the right direction. It can be the finger pointing to the moon. It isn't the moon. But if your finger is pointing the wrong direction, you can have all the frickin' experiences you want, but you won't get it because you think you're driving to San Francisco, but you're actually driving to Reno. So intellect is important as a pointer, not as a realization, but it can, if you have a strong conceptual frame and you're really locked and loaded to, I'm a terrible person, and by the way, the rest of you are too, then you can cut off, right? So, and then we can have all of other beneficial experiences, like the water of Dharma, the ocean of Dharma can completely cover you, but that hard kind of rock shell terminal uniqueness, which is still based off concept, but it can prevent. So, you know, that's why we say the sun is all over, huge, but if we just do this, then you block out the sun, right? So that's why we do spend some time at least trying to get right view. We give teachings. So even though it can't be taught, we want at least to point out the delusion, right? And point, say, don't point that way, point toward the moon, and then look that way. That makes sense, right? Yeah. So proper steady is important, because if we have an improper delusion, which is always going to be conceptual, and we don't examine that, then you can have many experiences. You can have all kinds of meditative experiences, but they won't turn to realizations. Capisce? Okay. So let's take a few questions, comments, or complaints. If this was the monastery, I'd call on people and I'd go, what did I just say in a nutshell? So, but I'm not going to do that because I'm super nice. Yeah. That really makes a difference, you know. And it doesn't amount to it. My teacher used to do that all the time. And not just after giving a talk, just in the middle of doing something, like blah, 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 blah. You know, and what's this, what's that? You know, so you don't get to have a drifting time off, right? Like, just because Taruko's taking notes, you know, I don't know if she's getting everything. You know, I could say it a million times, and, you know, I really appreciate it. And maybe we're recording it, I don't know. But it's still embarrassing to be called on, and then you go, oh. I was thinking about how I'm going to repair the swimming pool, you know, I mean, so. Okay. Susan first, okay, and then. Well, actually, we can't. Yeah, so that's why we need to remember the gathas, like Buddhists can't transfer realizations, we can't wash away sins with water, we can't heal just by laying out of hands, we can just teach. So we don't, in our tradition, of course, we really don't invade others' people's space, you know. We because you can't anyway, because whatever drill we have, they'd have a harder surface. We just keep throwing the jello against the wall. Yeah. We're like the water against the rock, you know. So we just keep teaching. We just keep calling it out. Oh, that's terminal uniqueness, and we laugh, you know. So we just keep doing that, and we actually kind of just wear it out in a sense, or because the nature of the mind, you know, nature of true. You know, Rigpa is that if you put delusion next to Rigpa, next to awareness, then we'll naturally see the problem. Okay, so that's always what we need to do in Dharma, is we're always trying to like take one polarity and the other polarity and put them together, because then we will see what is actually going on. That's always what we do. So in other traditions, they try to like, you know, get rid of it or something. You know, we always just place it like this and this. Okay, when people actually see them together like this, here is dog shit and here is ice cream, you're going to want to eat the ice cream. So we just have to keep doing that. You know, we just kind of keep presenting. So as bodhisattvas, actually, we wear ourselves out, because of course we all have a certain degree of terminal uniqueness, and we just wear people out, actually. Because the nature of the mind is that we keep presenting the delusion along with the truth, we'll see the middle way. It's really interesting. If we couldn't be able to do that, you know, we'd be totally screwed. So, but it might take eons. I don't know, you know. But look at it this way. You know, we've taken us eons, but now we're here. So, right? But, you know, we're not a salvation religion. You know, there's no way to just kind of rescue people. There's no way to invade people and change them. It always has to happen from the inside, right? Door opens from the inside. So, We're not aggressive or omnipotent in that way. We can't change merited karma. This is a grown-up religion. This is grown-up spirituality. We're not kids anymore. You know, you can't just kind of go, okay, I'm just going to intervene and, you know, rescue someone from their karma. You know, so we can provide a lot of support around it, right? You know, so if someone's struggling, we always give them support, and that helps, you know, like we're putting the truth next to idiocy, you know, so that's support. Or we can help cushion their karma in that sense, right? So, the good news is if we start good karma, which we are, then that's totally has to come to fruition, right? The whole thing's based on that, ladies and gentlemen. The whole thing's based on that, you know? The whole thing is based on if good results, good intentions will always end up in good results. Good starts will always have good results. So no good is ever destroyed. So when we say karma, sometimes people think fate, well, in a depressing way, but actually it's good news, because that means not determined. So if you create the good motivations and good actions, good realizations, then those must have fruition. You can't have a good start and then end up with a shitty end. Consequently, if you start out with, you know, really bad intention, you're going to end up with bad result. You may not see it immediately, but you'll end up with bad result. So this teaching is very profound. The Buddha can't, you know, go in and change someone's karma. We can dedicate our merit and our blessings, so we're surrounding that people with support, right? You know, but the support is kind of like someone's locked in their room, you know, and there's no, you know, they have to open it from the inside. We can say, hey, we're here, so when you come out, we've got some, you know, nice food. And it's safe, and we're not going to bag on you when you come out. But, you know, we can't make them open the door. We can't drill in and know, so many movies, books, and things are based on that childlike view that, you know, we can bust in and fix someone's karma, you know. So it's nice to have that view, but actually doesn't happen that way. Otherwise, we'd all be fine, right? Buddha's compassion's infinite. You know, we'd all just kind of, it would have happened years ago, and we'd just go, hey, thanks a lot, guy. You know, we're doing fine. But even though his realization was infinite, compassion infinite, we all have to do our own practice with lots of support, but that's called the teachings. Yes.
So are you saying that the terminal uniqueness is our karma?
Yeah, we've created that. So that's the other good thing about karma. Since we've created, it's karma still relative. If we've created it, right, we can uncreate it. We made it, so we can unmake it. If it was uncreated in that sense, from a relative point of view, it's like locked, then, so we really don't have terminal, you know, uniqueness, you know. But it feels so solid from its own side. Someone just like, I'm bad, stupid, and wrong, and don't try to talk me out of it. Okay. All right. Okay. You know, come back when you're ready. You know, that's, even the Buddha said, oh, sorry. You know, Buddha had to sometimes kick people out of the Sangha and doing all kinds of crazy things. But most of the time, people would go blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. And they'd say, well, this is the way I see it. And they'd go, I don't see it that way. And you'd go, okay, well, can't rescue you. The famous thing when a woman, understandably, you know, had lost her child, brought, you know, a dead baby before the Buddha, saying, please revive it. He gave a teaching saying, if you can bring me a handful of mustard seed from houses that had no death in them, then I will revive your baby, right? So she spent a long time going, knocking on each house in her village, and everybody had a death in their house, right? And then she came to some realization. Still grieving, but able to move on, right? So we just keep, we keep pitching. That's our bodhisattva practice. But sometimes we have to say, you know, like, go out and have some more life, see if that works for you. And when you're ready, if you want, come on back, right? We can't chase everybody down. It's sad, right? There's grieving there. I mean, but even the Buddha sometimes would say, you know, we see in the Pali Suttas and Lotus Sutra particularly, the Buddha would say, you fool, right? I don't know what the Pali is, but that was kind of a soft translation probably. You know, I'd say to a few people like, if you think you can do it that way, you're kind of an idiot, but you know, when you're ready, come on back, you know, like that. It's good. So we need to have these basic understandings, and then when we give the Mahamudra teachings, then we've at least created a non-delusional vessel, right? Or the possibility of it, or challenging, or, you know, idea that we're not worthy, or channeling the idea that, you know, we don't have to go through any experiences. Where, so we have the understanding can be taught in the same way that information is taught. It has to be heart. We have to develop the open-heartedness and confidence. We have to actually walk up the mountain and have the hardships, and then we're patient and we've developed the wisdom. Then we take it into the heart, and then we recognize our worthiness, and then we're ready. It's easy. It's easy. Okay. One last, any comment, question, or complaint before we break, and then we'll do contemplation on this. Makes sense, right? Yes, Sue. Yeah.
Dedicating any merit we may have accumulated with our efforts changing it our own negative time.
Yeah.
We can't really, others cannot absorb that merit. We are just providing merit surrounding them for support.
Well, support is really huge, right? So
we're dedicating this
when
to whatever we have
No, they can benefit from that support.
From the support.
Oh, sure, which is
getting the actual merit to change their karma. They're getting the support so that they can personally recognize this.
Yes. So, you know, just the act of saying, you know, may the benefits, which we do in every end of every practice, may the benefits of my practice go to support others. That means, you know, we're not holding, greedily holding on to our world, you know, which just zeroes it out, actually. So, you know, when we hear from others that they're willing to support us, then we can relax and look inside. You know, if we hear that, you know, we can't open the door because on the other side of the door are welcoming people, we're going to open the door. It's huge. I mean, so the causes and conditions that need to be set up for awakening are extremely important. It's just that those, you know, that by himself won't open the door. But we'll open the door if, you know, people say, you know, it actually is safe out here and we have food and drink for you and comfort and healing. So, you know, come on out. Or, you know, you're on the ledge and people say, you know, come on in, you know, whatever is going to bring people in, right? You know, here's your child, here's a six-pack of beer, or, you know, whatever it is, we're talking people off the ledge, right? So that's huge, right? But still, people have to say, I'm willing to come off the ledge, or I'm willing to open up the door. So we never take away someone's freedom. So that's why I say, as Lama, I never push someone off the diving board. You know, so there are a lot of folks that bounce on the diving board for a long time before they jump into Dharma or their life, you know, or jump into living fully. But if they jump for a while and, you know, they go, okay, I'm not going to jump, I don't push them, right? Then if you get pushed by a teacher or pushed by someone, you don't really experience the freedom and you don't experience that sense of initiative, right? You don't experience the real jump. You just feel pushed. You might end up in the water like everybody else, but you don't really experience the liberating, Rigpa mind, the real freedom, because you've been pushed. You don't get the confidence. You go, well, I didn't really do it myself. I inherited the money. I don't know how I got it. You know, like that. You don't really feel the release. It's tempting, you know, that's always tempting, you know, to kind of push a little bit because people want that. I can't do it. Just push me in, you know, just push me over. Yeah, but then that's Dharma cheating. So many people find teachers and religions and philosophies like that that will push them, right? So all the way from just being codependent, kind of nudges kind of people, teachers, to, you know, Jim Jones kind of teachers that will push people, right? So we don't do that in our tradition. You know, we go, okay, well, bounce on the board, not ready to go in this time. So this I learned as a camp counselor. So this is a real thing. So counseling like boys from, you know, 5 to like 18, and particularly 5-6 year olds, they're shivering, they don't want to jump in the cold lake in Maine, they're bouncing on the board, you know. Of course, their friends are going, jump in, you know, jump in, I'm waiting, jump in, let's go, you know. So I'm not yelling at the kid to jump in, right? I'm not going there pushing the kid in, right? People want that, right? Because they're, you know, like, I don't want to do the work. I want to find a teacher that will push me in, particularly if I pay them a lot of money, you know. But that's not the realization lineage that we're part of. That's bullshit, you know, so we don't do that. It's a drag. I mean, people get up on the diving board a lot, bounce around, and you feel like, people are waiting, you know, but we, you know, it's okay, just go back in, you know, we'll do it again tomorrow, so, you know, it's okay, it's really okay. So. Okay, we need to take another break and then we'll do some sitting. So we have the view, right? Okay. Om Aum. On retreat, or if you have get up early enough, like I do, then you have time for like some reading, right? Which is what the lecture is, right? So we do prayers, and then you know, it's good to do some Dharma reading. If we don't do some Dharma reading, we're probably going to be like a little bit off with the view, or we're going to be thinking about stuff during our non-discursive meditation, so we actually give the mind something to do. But it is also, you know, we're learning something. We're reading something that has to do with the view. So we might be reading kind of more relative Dharma talks, or, you know, we might be reading some profound passages, like just reading the Mahamudra text or Dzogchen or something. But we're actually, in a way, Heart Sutra is reading something, but we're probably doing a little bit also extra. So generally I ask people, like, what are you reading, you know? I tried to get people, many people have already, you know, I don't know, I lost count. Maybe 5 or 6 people have completed the foundations, Buddhist foundations course out of Jamyang, and so we have maybe 3 people here finished already. Susan, Ellen, and they're close. Dana's close. Marie's getting closer. Who else is taking the course currently? Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, yeah. So this really gives a very, you know, strong backbone like that. So, but then, you know, people are doing other kinds of reading too, which is beneficial. So we've done that. So then hopefully you've done that and you all have time to actually now do the yogic practice, right? So, okay. So second verse, for instance, consider space, what depends on what. Likewise, Mahamudra, it doesn't depend on anything. Don't control, let go, and rest naturally. Let what binds you let go, and freedom is not in doubt. I'll just say it one more time. For instance, consider space. What depends on what? Likewise, Mahamudra, it doesn't depend on anything. Don't control, let go, and rest naturally. Let what binds you let go, and freedom is not in doubt. So we've done energy, then the verse, and then when we do the meditation, we're now, at this point, not discursive meditation, we're now repeating the verse to ourselves. We get it like the joke. And then we rest in the nature of mind, right? You're now repeating the verse to yourself. Do you want me to repeat it one more time so you get the joke? Okay. For instance, consider space. What depends on what? Likewise, Mahamudra. It doesn't depend on anything. Don't control. Let go and rest naturally. Let what binds you let go, and freedom is not in doubt. We really don't have to say anymore. We just stop there and go home. Forget it. Easy. Okay. So, say a few things theoretically. Because once again, even though theory is helpful, you know. Generally in Mahamudra, you know, they're kind of, we like to break things down into simple, like threes or something. Nature of mind, nature of reality is this knowing. The mind knows where this knowingness. But it's empty knowing. We can't find an entity that knows, and we can't find an entity that we know. We can't find a subject entity that knows a something object. It's just pure awareness, pure knowing. So that's first. Then second is the mind is this clarity, this vividness. Our experience, particularly a phenomenal world, is extremely vivid. Sometimes the term luminous is used. It's just kind of so so precise, so completely apparent. Then third, the the mind is unimpeded and all pervasive. Our experience, there's nothing outside of our experience, you know. There's no, like, the mind stops here, our awareness stops here, and then the other side is, I don't know, the end of the universe or something. No, this is completely completely unlimited, unimpeded is sometimes the word used. So we talk about those three things, but primarily this empty knowing, this no subject, object, and this complete vividness, luminous even, than completely open like space. So Mahamudra, like particularly Tolopa's, we like talking about space a lot, you know, spaciousness. And nothing holds, you know, there's no resting in space, right? Space just open. We don't have to rest the mind anywhere. And most of the meditations, we're always saying, put your mind on your breath, put your mind on your, you know, this thought, put your mind on this energy, put it down. So, like space doesn't rest anywhere. So we say rest naturally, but this, you know, it's like free fall rest, right? It's really relaxing. I'm going to say a bit more about Mahamudra, do another meditation after the break, and then we have lunch break, about 12 to 1, and then 1 to 3, I'm going to give teachings on which I've done on the retreat, also on the three tenets, three principles from first Dzogchen, human Dzogchen teacher, Garb Dorje. So we'll be going over that at 1 o'clock. That has three too. That's easy, right? But it's difficult to say rest in the mind that rests on nothing, yeah? But it's easy. Okay, so we'll take a 10-minute break, right? Yeah, good. Is the light weird?
No, it's different.
Yeah, we turned on the light. We're talking about making it a little easier for photographers. Because, yeah, so like that. Probably noticed we brought in all the blue chairs. It isn't just for my aesthetic need. Although that's a piece of it. As much as I love the maroon chairs, they have too much of a slope. Okay, these have very slight slope, but when sitting in a chair, we still want to have our pelvis higher than our knees. So, you know, I've donated a few wedge cushions, which are also nice because they have that little carve out. But generally, chair is fine. It's that people lean back in the chair, or you know, their knees are higher than their pelvis, their butt, so it rounds out the back, you see. And you really can't sustain a comfortable, effort-free meditation very long without fairly good posture, particularly not with the more advanced meditations that require, you know, the energy work and the awareness. So no chair is perfect, no body is perfect, no cushion is perfect, but proper posture, which is, because what we do is yoga, folks, you know, is important when doing real awareness meditations rather than just kind of discursive meditations. So maybe we'll get even some more wedges, you know. Be nice to supply those. If you need support, and sometimes we do, then you know, put the back support behind the chair so you're in line with gravity. Looks like Sharon, you're doing that, so you're you know, so even though you're not kind of away from the back of the chair, you're not kind of doing this. Yeah, that makes sense, right? And then sometimes we have to put a cushion on the floor too, so our feet aren't dangling or like that. Depending on the chair and someone's body, like your feet can be flat on the floor or sometimes crossed a little bit. I've read meditation manuals that say, never cross your feet when sitting in a chair. Have you ever read that? Well, in that case, never sit down with crossed legs. I mean, it doesn't make sense, you know. But because most chairs are kind of hard, you know, if your legs are crossed and your ankles are kind of crossed, you'll cut off some circulation. So if I'm sitting in a chair, sometimes I alternate. But you, in any case, it's not such a big problem. You could have them straight or crossed. I think a lot depends upon the padding of the chair and the padding on the derriere, the chair and the derriere, right? Okay. So the way, the classical way that is presented, Mahamudra in Sokchen 2, which I like to do it classically, is we just present it right, highest teachings right from the top, okay? Now, the role of the student is to try to do that, to try to do the meditations, and fail. Okay, so we say, okay, just do it, and just be easy, just rest, and okay, I'll do it. And then you can't do it. So that's when we go to path Mahamudra, right? So we establish ground Mahamudra, and maybe if you're maybe like exceptional student, like, you know, you just hear it once and you get it, but don't even worry about that. So in our tradition, we put it right out there, and you'll get a little piece of it, but then you'll find out that we're losing the view, so to speak. We cannot maintain just resting in the natural state, can't just have a space-like nature of clarity and knowing. So we need to do something, right? We need to do path Mahamudra. if people, when I introduce, when teacher introduce the view, there's this kind of getting, like getting the joke, but that doesn't mean you've become a comedian, right? So being in the audience is not the same as being a master. So when students say, yeah, I got the view and that's it, and there's no path Mahamudra or path Dzogchen, they're in trouble, right? I'm in trouble because then I've got a rogue student that thinks they're, you know, really got it, you know. So I've got a bigger problem, you know. And I don't need more problems, so. So in path Mahamudra, as explained in retreat, and go over briefly, it's broken down into what's called the four yogas. And first yoga is the yoga of one-pointedness. That means we actually can, we've developed enough energy, enough concentration mind that we basically can stick with it. We can stay with our experience. We can stay with our lived experience rather than go off into our explanation and fantasy. Dzogchen does a little preview. A little bit Dzogchen style is a little bit more like emphasis on now, you know, immediate experience, you know. So like there's some, it is now an immediate non-conceptual Mahamudra, but really in Dzogchen really like emphasize on now, you know, the now mind, the now awareness, yeshe, you know. So in the one-pointedness, we're really staying with the now in Mahamudra too. You know, we're not drifting off into, you know, what are we doing after the retreat kind of thing. Staying with our own lived experience. What's our own lived experience? It's what you're experiencing right now, yeah? Easy. Except, of course, we tend to drift off, yeah. So we practice yoga of one-pointedness. Yeah, so then, I know I'm kind of going through this quick, but then yoga of non-conceptuality. Yoga of non-conceptuality is, even though we say I'm staying with my lived experience, staying present with myself, we tend to see, even then we're advanced practitioners, we tend to see like our thoughts and distractions as a problem. You know, Lamala, how can I get rid of my thoughts kind of thing, right? So in the yoga non-conceptuality, you realize, well, thoughts aren't a problem. They're just expressions of mind. Waves are same as ocean, right? Ocean doesn't worry about the waves. You worry about the waves if you're identified with the little boat on the ocean, but the ocean itself doesn't worry about waves, right? Mind waves. Still nature mind. Do you have to push them away? Do you have to entertain them? No. So non-conceptuality doesn't mean like then we push concepts out, as many people think, you know, like I just want a blank mind. The nature of thoughts inherently nature mind. Where else could they come from? So just like mind itself, empty of independence, they're interdependent. It's great. So in Mahamudra, we're not thinking, well, I've got to get rid of all my thoughts. So that's why sometimes for some of you, I give an example, like isn't it very relaxing, like you go to the mall and you do your shopping and then you're tired of walking around, you've done your shopping and then you sit down, millions of people walking by, but it's kind of relaxing, you just watch them coming and going, right? Very relaxing, you know? You're just, you may be noticing a little bit, oh, this person looked like that, but it's relaxing because you've done your shopping, you're happy to sit down, and it's kind of just nice. You're not like running after them, right? The way normal people are like, hey, you know, oh no. And then you're running after everybody in the mall. Hey, why are you wearing that? What's your name? You know, but that's what ordinary, you know, that's called ordinary sentient beings. This is like you're jumping up and you're stopping strangers, and no wonder they're shocked. So then yoga of one flavor. Then, you know, then we're really, you know, really sinking in to, it just has one taste, you know, complete taste of unfindable, we can't find any fixation whatsoever. It's empty. You know, we can't find any stuck place whatsoever. You know, so famous Mahamudra verse by like third Karmapa says, you know, if you think this is it, it still isn't it. If you think this isn't it, it still isn't it. You know, because you're fixating, right? And it's, you know, everything has one, you know, it's not like, can't be emptiness over here and solidity over there, right? Can't, it's one taste. It's all liberated. So it even goes back to early sutras by the Buddha. You know, my teaching has one taste, just like the ocean has one taste, the taste of liberation. So in our tradition, particularly in Mahamudra, we're talking about freedom and liberation. We're talking about self-liberation. Self, you know, ranjung. So we're not talking about transforming. We're not talking about rescuing. We're not talking about being good people. We're liberating. So has one taste. That's easy. Then yoga of non-meditation. Really, in a way, yoga of non-meditation is like 10th bodhisattva level, bodhisattva bhumi, Buddhahood. You know, we're not. There's no distinction between, you know, formal practice, where we're calling it meditation, and daily life. So, in a way, though, that's still like some kind of recognition that we go on even path Mahamudra. We start seeing like, hey, I was in the past taking the bait on that, and I didn't take the bait on that comment by that person. You know, the last year or 2 years ago, this situation would have, you know, spun me, but no, I'm just doing it, you know. We recognize like that. We can't say we've attained non-meditation, but we're recognizing like, oh, it, you know. You know, it's almost really weird. We have to have that experience, like, it's really weird, but this shit works. So we kind of notice, like, oh, something's changed, you know. We haven't, it's not like, you know, intentional meditation where we've gone, okay, I'm meeting with someone who normally really annoys me, so I'm going to be good bodhisattva and keep my mouth shut and be patient, you know, that's. In non-meditation, we just would recognize, oh, because there's still recognition. When you say non-meditation, it isn't like we're, you know, clueless. No, it's like, wow, that's interesting. I didn't apply any antidote. I didn't make any special kind of effort to be patient. Then, you know, I can say, then you get this kind of really irreversible confidence. As it, you know, as those experiences become, you know, a little bit more frequent. Because initially we think, well, we'll just always have to keep applying. Like, I just got to remember when I walk in the room, that person's going to be there, so I've got to armor up, and I hope I don't run into him. But if I do, I'm going to be here all, you know. No, it's like this in non-meditation, you're not making any intentionality to be a certain way. Likewise, we're not making any, you know, we're not making intentionality to be nice or mean or anything. We're not programming our awareness in any way. It's just things seem to be kind of working. Yeah. Yes. No self-hypnosis, right? Yeah, you know, we're not spinning anything. You know, it's just wow. So then, you know, as that becomes more and more matured, then of course that's like so liberating, right? You just feel like you don't have to pre-plan. You don't have to be on guard. Awareness isn't be aware. Like, you better be aware, you know. No, it's just, wow. So those are the very famous four yogas. So I've gone through those very fast. But just to recap before we sit still here is that students, classically, correct way, is we try to do the practice from the highest level, and then we come to the Lama and Darshan and say, you know, I can't quite do it. If you can do it right away, you're faking it. Okay? If you say, I got the Heart Sutra, or this is easy, you know. No, it's hard. Non-meditation is easy. But, the majority of our practice is Path Mahamudra, right? This Grand Mahamudra, Path Mahamudra, Fruition Mahamudra, you know, same way with Dzogchen, you know. So, if someone's said I got it the first time, I go, oh gosh, I've got a problem. If somebody says, you know, I get an idea of it and I can see a little bit and I just need to keep working, then I go, okay, this is good, you know. Like that. Okay. We'll take one question and then we need to sit. La la la. Okay. Somewhat sequential, yeah, somewhat sequential. It never really works out sequential, but generally there has to be at least some appreciation. We just kind of keep going back through them, but, you know, there's you wouldn't say I've mastered non-meditation until you've mastered the previous. You wouldn't say I've mastered one flavor until you've mastered, you know, one-pointedness or non-conceptuality, you know. But the way our tradition goes is that you're kind of introduced to everything, and you know, so that we know the full mandala, and then we're humbly confident and frustrated, right? Inspired frustration is called being on the path, right? Yeah, inspired frustration. Yeah, that rings a bell, doesn't it? Yeah. Yeah, I was like, you know. Okay, so now we have our. Let's say you're on a month-long retreat. You would start off like this kind of slowly. You know, doing maybe just starting off with 6 minute meditations, then little break, at least stretching, maybe not leaving cushion, then 12 minutes, then 18, then 24, then 48. You know, you'd maybe first week you just keep to maybe max 24 minutes, you know. But at the end, traditionally, you'd be on your cushion for 4 hours, you know. And then you'd take a break after the 4 hours, and you'd have 4 sessions a day, so 16 hours, you know. So you'd work up to it, right? We're not doing, you know, if you just slam yourself into it, it's not good, you know. It's like slamming on the brakes when you're going 80 miles an hour. You're going to roll or skid or something. So, of course, here we, you know, I'm giving teachings and so forth. But even at home, if you have time, you know, start off little and then build up. That's the way, you know. So quality at first. So you're not just kind of just sitting there. Because I hear people say, well, you're not, it's not doing you any good unless you sit 45 minutes or something. Well, then you might as well say it's not doing any good if you don't do anything for 45 minutes. There are a lot of good things you can do for under 45 minutes. So, but we build into it, right? So we're not ambitious that way. And also, and maybe didn't mention, and Mahamudra Dzogchen style practice, generally your eyes are open. You're just gazing either straight ahead or not down too far. We're not closing our eyes because we're opening all our sense doors, right? All the Buddha families are open. And we're not centralizing inward or outward. Most people think meditation is inward, right? There's no in and out, actually. It's a joke. So we're right in the middle. We're not centralizing in like I'm just going in. You know, you have that idea, I'm going in. Likewise, we're not going out. Usually, you know, going out would be I'm noticing God or the Buddhas or Bodhisattvas outside. We're in the middle, not centralizing actually anywhere. That's easy, right? So eyes are, no, it's not easy, it's hard, no. So our eyes are open and soft gaze, and we're just present in the room. We're not trying to be just in ourselves or not in ourselves. We're just in this situation, right? Just, we're just here. So you don't have to go inside or outside. It's nice, huh? So traditionally during lunch breaks, the ideas were maintaining Vajrapride of the deity. So we're not just running around kind of going, okay, I gotta do Mahamudra or Dzogchen or something. But we are taking the view that we're, well, really princes and princesses that are servants. That's Vajrayana view, right? So that's why we Bodhisattvas, we have the beautiful or in Sambhogakaya Buddhas, the beautiful jewelry, silks, and so forth. And we're in our mandala palace temple or mansion, and we're being very gracious hosts, right? But we're being, you know, we're royalty, right? So we're feeling that sense of confidence and pride and a sense of, I don't know, being beautiful people, kind of like that. Yeah. So that's why we're visualizing and imagining many times the different sadhanas where you have the jewels and the crowns and the luminous bodies like that. So we maintain that experience of being royalty, that are servants, that are here to serve. Putting those two together, right? Usually royalty is like, I'm royalty, you're not. I'm, you know, we all have our idea of miniature. I'm special, right? So I'm special, you're not. So here we kind of out ourselves. We're royalty, and we're here to notice, to serve, to be hosts, right? That you bring those two ideas together. So likewise, when we're eating, we don't have a normal view of eating. We, by offering it to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, visualizing pure view, it becomes amrita, becomes, you know, wonderful, delicious, blissful medicine. No calories. So we'll do whatever meal prayers you like, but you want to maintain the view, right? You're not just doing ordinary activities like, okay, great break, now I'm, you know, off. You're maintaining Vajrapride. But usually from this Mahayoga, Sambhogakaya style, right? Okay, we'll be back at 1. And for those who need to leave, thank you for being here, contributing energy. For those who are staying or coming at 1, we'll be giving pith instructions on Dzogchen. So, see ya. Yeah, someone's got to do it. Yeah, imaho. La la la.